As a historian, it gives me great pleasure to introduce Frances Fitzgerald tonight. As you know, Frankie Fitzgerald has made her mark as a journalist and nonfiction writer. She has worked in North America, Southeast Asia, the Middle East, Europe, Central America, and the South Pacific. She has written for The New Yorker, The Atlantic Monthly, Harper's, The New York Times Magazine, The Nation, The Esquire, Architectural Digest, Rolling Stones, and other publications. She's written three books, City on a Hill, 1986, America Revised, and Fire in the Lake, The Vietnamese and the Americans in Vietnam in 1972. Fire in the Lake was awarded the Pulitzer Prize, the National Book Award, and the Bancroft Prize for History. As a historian, let me tell you how impressive that last prize is. Very few non-academic historians ever win prizes conferred by history academic organizations. And that's what the Bancroft Prize is. It's from a history organization. It speaks to the professional historian's respect for Fitzgerald's work. Perhaps her earning the Bancroft Award should be no surprise. Ms. Fitzgerald is the great-grandniece of the father of all American historians, the great Francis Parkman. Moreover, Ms. Fitzgerald majored in Middle Eastern history at Radcliffe College, and while Ms. Fitzgerald is a professional journalist, she has made her mark writing about topics with historical resonances. The reviews of her work by professional historians have always praised the depth of her research and insightful analysis of the very thing the historians are always interested in, primary source material. Historians have treated her works as academic history, except, unlike almost all academic history, her works are actually read by people and enjoyed. Tonight we are gathered to hear her talk about revisiting the subject of her book, America Revised. That book is an in-depth survey of the nature of American grade through high school history textbooks in the late 19th and 20th century. It's an exploration into the forces that helped determine what those textbooks were, what was in them, their rather odd nature. She's taking a new look at the topic 20 years after her last look, looking at the most recent crop of school texts, and she is to report what she has seen and what she thinks about it. I give you Frances Fitzgerald.
Thank you very much, Richard Hamm, and thank you to the New York Writers Institute. It's a great institution. When I finished America Revised in 1979, I swore I would never read another textbook again. I'd read through perhaps 100 in American history from the early 19th century on, and I think I began on that reading because it occurred to me that textbooks were sort of artifacts of popular culture, and ones that were largely unexamined at the time. I wanted to know how the textbooks were managing to assimilate all the political and cultural shakeups of the 1960s and early 70s. I couldn't imagine how they would do it. Well, I learned more than I had bargained for. I'm not a professional historian. My own school education based on textbooks convinced me that American history was deadly dull. So on getting to college, I went as far as possible away from it. When I began this book in the 70s, I worried about my lack of qualifications. I worried only briefly, though, because journalists simply can't worry about such subjects. Besides, I felt I was the perfect average reader. I would never have to worry about what wasn't in the textbooks, or how American history ought to be taught by the latest standards of scholarship, because I wouldn't have any idea about that. I could just describe what was in the text. As I said, I swore never to read another textbook again after I finished America Revised. And as awful as the task of reading them is, these books have some importance. They're important to schools, for according to educationists, these texts are used in 85 to 90% of the classrooms across the country. And while they're normally not the only materials used by teachers, they tend to provide the background for a course of studies. When I sat down to read the American history texts of the 1990s, I wondered if I would feel like Rip Van Winkle, awoken from a long sleep. For as I discovered doing my first researches, the version of American history presented in the text changes every few years or so. So I wondered whether everything would have changed and whether I would even recognize my surroundings. As a child growing up in the 1950s, I thought my textbooks were something like the mosaic tablets, the truth of American history, the truth impervious. I thought those textbooks would never change, even though they seemed to contradict the reality around me and the history that my parents taught me. I learned that texts were instead nervous objects, which react to all the prevailing political and pedagogical currents. For example, my own history texts of the 1950s began with Christopher Columbus and proceeded serenely through the exploration and settlement of the American continent by the English and their progeny on these shores. These texts were still wary of immigrants, by which they meant the Southern and Eastern Europeans who came to the United States after 1890. They asked students to show tolerance for such people and to recognize the, quote, contributions made by such as Lily Pons, Albert Einstein, and Irving Berlin. For some reason, they only mentioned artists and intellectuals, I think because they thought that these were sort of essentially powerless people. And I began to think that there was a whole generation of students growing up who believed that those with other than Anglo-Saxon names must be artists or intellectuals. Anyway, needless to say, these texts of the 50s had a sort of Scarlett O'Hara view about slavery, the Civil War, Reconstruction, and all the heroes of the text were dead white men. Those texts approved of most everything that happened in this country since the American Revolution. There were certain exceptions. My own eighth grade text, one written by David Saville Muzzy, one of the great textbook writers whose books continued on in the schools long, long after he'd written them. That text disapproved of President Jackson, for his uncouth populist manners. And Muzzy, who was a New Englander, sort of roundly condemned the Mexican War. But most of the texts of the 50s had gotten into line. They approved of Manifest Destiny, of American imperial adventures in the Caribbean, Central America, and the Philippines. And their sails were filled with American exceptionalism. Indeed, they married 19th century American imperialism to the growth of American power during the Cold War years. These texts were, of course, profoundly pro-business. Their watchword was progress, by which they meant scientific, technical, and material progress. And they were quite hysterically anti-communist. One of them, I remember, had a map of the world divided into, you know, communist countries and free, and there was sort of some intermediate category because they couldn't figure out what to do with places like Indonesia, which they sort of didn't quite fit on either side. And some of them actually had instructions to the students about what to do if approached by subversives. Report them to the FBI, they said. Well, when I came to read the texts of the 1970s, I did feel a bit like Rip Van Winkle because the texts, somewhat belatedly, were responding to all the changes in American social and political attitudes in the 60s. Columbus was now a walk-on figure in the middle of American history, the Native Americans having preceded him, and the Vikings as well. The newer European immigrants had finally become assimilated, and notably, there were, for the first time, some number of black Americans in the text. In the 1950s, there had only been George Washington Carver and his peanuts. Now there was Crispus Attucks, the Boston Massacre, Frederick Douglass and the Civil War, some account of the civil rights movement of the 1950s and 60s, plus black faces in pictures of crowds and military formations and stuff. Then to American history was no longer a serene progress from triumph to triumph. Indeed, it seemed that there were many problems. The word problems occurred hundreds of times in the 1970s text. There were problems with pollution, problems with suburban sprawl, problems for black Americans, problems for immigrants, and so forth. Even technological advances, such as automation, were also creating problems. Well, still, the fact that American Indians, black Americans, Mexican Americans, and so forth appeared in these texts didn't mean that their positions were really represented. For these texts, like their predecessors in the 1950s, remained texts without social conflict. Native Americans, for example, were said to be struggling for full rights. But what they were struggling against was not mentioned, and nor indeed why it became necessary for them to struggle at all. Instead of conflicts, there were, as I say, problems. One New York State curriculum for the social studies described slavery as a problem for black Americans. Problems such as these cropped up without antecedent or cause. They materialized in a sort of surreal fashion, like the Cheshire Cat, and suddenly all Americans were working to solve them. In the whole of American history, no one had ever created a problem for anyone else. Our president certainly never created problems, because the Vietnam War was said to be a problem for President Johnson. And even better, Watergate was said to be a problem for Richard Nixon. The Watergate break-in just cropped up and made Nixon so beleaguered he had to resign. The 1970s was perhaps one of the more embarrassing moments in the history of textbook publishing, for the publishers were trying to deal with a cultural maelstrom whose consequences they could not foresee. In the texts of the 1990s, or those relatively few I have read, those particular eccentricities have largely vanished. There are some social conflicts in these texts. There are some people who create problems for others. Watergate no longer presents a problem for Nixon. My pals Woodward and Bernstein appear in these books. In the junior high school texts, where, in line with the state curriculum, the emphasis has always been on social as opposed to political history, the changes which began in the 1970s have become better realized. For example, Native Americans, who used to appear only at the very beginning of the books and then vanish, now appear in virtually every unit. The American Nation, which is the Prentice Hall 7th, 8th grade text, which I'm told is fairly widely used in this state, has, I think, four sections with large full-color maps showing how this nation forced Native Americans off their lands at different points in the 18th and 19th centuries. This text is itself a trail of tears. All of the texts have become more accurate and better informed on the civilizations which preceded ours on this continent and in the Western Hemisphere generally. Furthermore, most texts now, quite refreshingly, insist that the U.S. has neighbors. Neighbors in the Caribbean, in Central Latin America, and yes, neighbors in Canada as well. This discovery, of course, has led them to question American imperialism in the 1890s. Well, as in the case of Native Americans, African Americans appear in almost every unit of these texts, junior high school texts, from the Revolutionary War on, and so do Hispanics and other ethnic groups, and so do women. Disabled Americans are beginning to appear in the last chapters, and I believe we will soon begin to hear about disabled Americans in the Revolution and the Civil War. All this is to the good. Yet there are still some signs of indigestion from the force-feeding of racial, ethnic, feminist, and other concerns. The American Nation, for example, gives 2.5 columns of text to Sally Wister, a young woman who wrote a diary during the Revolutionary War about harboring a soldier in her house. Sally Wister got nowhere near the war and has nothing to say about it. But here are these 2.5 columns on this woman who was there, and there's only a half a column on Valley Forge. In addition, there remains a good deal of striving without much to strive against, a tendency reinforced by the fact that these texts feature prominent and accomplished people from every group at every period of history. The texts are still bleak and elliptical about slavery, in fact, more so perhaps than in the 70s. There are no slaves anymore, rather there are enslaved peoples. The term was adopted to suggest that slavery was a temporary condition imposed upon people and not a part of the essence of them as human beings. Fair enough, but slave is a very stark and powerful word, and perhaps it expresses much more accurately the horror of what it was to be a human being who was owned, bought, and sold. Furthermore, the enslaved persons in the illustrations of these texts tend to be beautifully dressed, almost as it were in the Vivien Leigh production of Gone with the Wind. Similarly, of course, the texts tell us a great deal about women reformers in the 19th century without telling us what they were trying to reform. Certainly not in the period of the Constitution. The Constitution remains the greatest document ever written by the hand of man, and so therefore, at that point, they don't tell you that neither blacks nor women were not allowed to vote. They tell you that a bit later on, but in that, the Constitution is still enshrined in this way, almost sort of cut off from the rest of history. Then to current texts for high school as well as junior high have other similarities to textbooks past. First of all, there's almost no treatment of religion in this country, even though for the first 3 centuries of American history, religion was the main transmission belt of ideas. But then there's almost no intellectual history of any sort in these books. They simply won't deal with it. I can't understand why. You hardly get Locke, much less William James. Or even, you know, simple or more popular kinds of ideas. They're not there. Even worse, in my view, there is no sense that, as one text puts it in its introduction, that the past is another country. That the past is a place where people thought very differently, where they behaved very differently, where they died young, where there was no electricity, you know. I mean, there is no sense from these textbooks that, you know, the founding fathers lived any differently than we did or actually thought very differently. And then, of course, there's the general rule of textbooks, which has not so far been much of an exception, and that is that they're incredibly dull. But actually, there is one exception to this rule I've been told about. Alexander Stiele in the New York Review of Books tells us that there is a series, a little-known one, by a woman called Joy Hockham, who's a writer who simply went about writing a narrative history of the United States using modern scholarly sources, and writing it in engaging prose. I suspect these texts are for 7th and 8th graders, and I want to quote you one paragraph that appears in the New York Review, because it seems to me to illustrate what is missing from most text narratives. It's about Columbus crossing the ocean blue in 1492. Here's the paragraph. In mid-September, they came to what seems to be a meadow of grass in the middle of the ocean. It is the Sargasso Sea, an area of thick green seaweed. The sailors have never seen anything like this. They are afraid that the ships will get tangled in the green muck. But soon they are out of it and into the open sea again. The sea seems endless. On October 9, they say they will go no farther. Columbus pleads for 3 more days of sailing. Then, he says, if they don't see land, they may cut off his head and sail home in peace. Well, you get a lot there because we understand that, you know, they're threatening to cut off his head. I mean, this is serious business out there. And it's also, you know, not something, this is the past as past. You know, these sailors are not cruise ship line sailors, you know. And you get a sense of this extraordinary adventure that they were embarked on and how impossible it seemed. Contrast this to a passage I found in a book for the same grade level. It's called For the People, By the People. It says this. It says, Columbus was a good sailor. He was also lucky. At the distance where he planned to find Asia, he did find land. It was a green island in warm blue waters. It was one of a group now known as the Bahamas. Columbus named it San Salvador. He found what is now Cuba and Hispaniola. In Hispaniola, he started a settlement. He also saw people. Thinking he was in the Indies, he called them Indians, and so forth. Well, you know, apart from the sort of sheer gracelessness of this prose, it's virtually meaningless, this paragraph. It's sort of a piling up of names that are unfamiliar to students. And it's furthermore wrong. San Salvador, as I happen to know, is not a green island in blue waters. It's a sandy strip of land out in the middle of the Atlantic. And kids would have difficulty finding Hispaniola on the map since it's occupied by Haiti and the Dominican Republic. You know, you wonder what the point of this is. Still, they have his landing right, and the American nation used in this state says that Columbus first landed on a small Caribbean island, which is not the case. Well, so what about the ambitions of the New York State Regents and Board of Education for improvement in the teaching of the social studies? Well, I wish I knew how they plan to do it with the textbooks available and with the amount that they pay teachers these days. And there, in my view, there's a third obstacle, perhaps more important. And that is the New York State Social Studies curriculum. This curriculum is much the same as the curricula in other states. It's been there for a very long time, perhaps forever. But in my view, it's an almost insurmountable obstacle to the teaching of critical thinking and all the other skills that New York wants its students to have. Look at what the state asks that kids be taught grade by grade in the social studies. Grade 1 is self and others. Grade 2 are communities. Grade 3, communities around the world. Grade 4, New York State history. Grade 5, US, Canada, and Latin American history. Grade 6, the Eastern Hemisphere, or in other words, the whole rest of the world. So, up until grade 6, we have what I think of as a Confucian sequence. You know, can control myself, control others. You know, out and out. It's sort of out from self to in concentric circles. In my view, that's not the right way to proceed. I have a feeling that children like to learn about stuff that captures their imagination. However foreign it is from their direct experience. Dinosaurs, Eskimos, the Mahabharata, you know, something out there. Anyway, I remember this as childhood, and most of the kids I know now, that's the way they feel too. But leaving that aside, look at the sequence again. In fourth grade, kids have to go all through New York State history from beginning to end, starting with the Native Americans, proceeding through the explorers, the colonizers, the Revolutionary War, the Constitution of the State of New York, and so forth to the present. In grade five, they have to do the same thing all over again for the entire country. The Native Americans, the colonizers, the Revolutionary War, the Constitution, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. In grade six, they get a break on a new subject, the whole rest of the world. But then, of course, as these concentric circles grow out, the amount of material to be covered grows exponentially as well. In math and in the sciences, teaching proceeds in a logical fashion from the simple to the complex. This is not the case with the social studies, at least from grade four on. After all, New York State history is just as conceptually difficult as any other piece of history. And while it may be possible to describe the whys and wherefores of a state constitution to fourth graders, if that's all you're doing, you wonder what fourth graders are going to make of a survey course that includes not only the state constitution, but 100 other equally difficult to grasp phenomena, such as the rise and decline of cities, wars, migrations, and so forth. What do kids gain from this survey? Possibly they'll remember that Albany is the state capital and a few other salient facts, but what else will they learn? And how can they learn the basics of geography or economics when they have to rush on to tariffs and environmental law in the fourth grade? If you take a look at the textbooks for grades 4, 5, and 6, and the grades of these textbooks are all the reading levels for those grades, of course, I think you would come to the conclusion that I did, that these surveys cannot be taught in an intellectually respectable fashion to 9, 10, and 11-year-olds. Well, we get to grades 7 and 8. Kids have a two-year sequence of U.S. sort of plus New York State history, in which they have to plow through the same old material again, the Native Americans, the explorers, the colonizers, the revolution, on through Watergate. This time in slightly more leisurely fashion, since they have 2 years to do it, but still it's another survey. The theme is social history in these years, but the texts I have read, and therefore the courses, go through everything else as well, trades and tariff laws, foreign policy, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Grades 9 and 10, the kids do 2 years of global history, or the whole world, including the United States. In grade 11, they do another survey of American history, this time with more political emphasis, but nonetheless, they are back again to the Native Americans, the Revolutionary War, George Washington, blah, 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 so on, up to Watergate. In grade 12, they do half a year of government and half a year of, well, government, it's actually a civics course, and half a year of economics. Again, mainly U.S. government and U.S. economics. This is an awful lot of U.S. history, 7 years of it between grades 4 and grade 12, compared to 3 years of the whole rest of the world. It's a bit parochial, I'd say, and it leaves little room for the basic facts of European, Chinese, Indian, or African history, or most of human civilization on this planet. But leave that aside. Even in U.S. history courses, teachers and students are running a marathon from the 16th to the 20th centuries every year, or every 2 years. And I suppose we're blessed that our history is so short. So, dear Board of Regents and Board of Ed, give our students a break. Order them to study anything, anything. Han China, ancient Egypt, the Italian Renaissance, even the American Revolution, anything in depth so that they can develop some understanding of geography, of history, and culture before doing the necessary survey of American history. But don't force all this textbook survey pap down their throats year after year and then tell them that they can't think. Thank you.
In 1979, your book, America Revised, A Study of American History Textbooks in the 20th Century, was published. It started out as some New Yorker articles. How did you come to write these articles in this book?
Well, I guess I wrote the whole thing, and then it was published in the New Yorker. They used to publish books in those days. It started out with the sort of curiosity on my part of how the textbooks had managed to assimilate the cultural revolution of the 1960s and early 70s, mm-hmm. Because I couldn't imagine that they could.
It was a present-minded kind of enterprise.
It was.
You started at the present and went backwards.
Right. Well, I remembered my old history text from the 1950s, and I remember thinking that they represented some world apart, which would never change. It was, you know, like an alternate world to the one that I lived in and my parents lived in and so forth. And that this version of American history was going to be there forever. It turned out not to be true, of course, and that history textbooks are sort of nervous objects which change every 5 or 10 years.
By the 1930s, the American history textbooks had achieved dullness. How did they achieve this dullness? What are the forces that pushed them to dullness?
Well, I think that on one hand, it's the pressures from state education boards and so on that want to them sort of turned out so that they don't hurt anybody's feelings, that they sort of have a sort of right down the center, whatever the center is in any particular period, approach to ancient and modern history, and also pressure groups from the outside who complain that they're doing this too much or doing that too much. And then, of course, they're not really written by anybody. I mean, they used to be in the 20s and before that written by school teachers or historians, people whose names appeared on the cover. But because of these various pressures to conform, they became written entirely within the textbook houses. And, of course, people within the textbook houses are not historians, and they're not writers in particular. And I don't think that they've ever thought about what it is to write for children and to engage them, you know, something like that.
Yeah, you talk about continuity and, sustained continuity in the American history textbooks, and you take them, you know, through a whole series of periods, and we'll come back to that later. But you talked about continuities, but then sharp hairpin turns, and that kind of brings us back to the first question, where you started talking about, as you were looking at textbooks in your time, and remembering your childhood textbooks, and what were they presenting about the current time?
Well, to start a bit backwards, before that, textbooks from the 30s through the 50s went through a very gradual evolution, generally from the more liberal textbooks of the 30s to the more conservative ones of the 50s. Along comes the 1960s, and everything has to change. The Newark and Detroit school boards have black majorities on them. They insist that these racist books change. After that, other groups get into the act because they see that that they're actually, you can change them, they're vulnerable. And finally, you know, in the early 70s, along come women and say, why aren't we in the textbooks too? So there was a terrific period of turmoil for the textbook publishers. I mean, in the beginning, it was so embarrassing. They were actually sort of dry pointing in black faces into crowds and military formations and so forth. And then they had a sort of terrific tokenism period where, you know, they went around trying to search for black heroes. And for a while, they were only the only ones I could find were George Washington Carver and Ralph Bunch. I mean, that was it. And they're not great on research, you see. So it took really until now to where they've got things sort of straight.
Oh, so they do have them straight. I mean, you've recently revisited textbooks. Can you give us a progress report on the various topics covered? I mean, In America Revised, you had this wonderful section on the Dunning School of Reconstruction, which had shaped textbook history, really from the emergence of the Dunning School at the end of the Progressive Era, right into the 1950s. And then by the 60s and 70s, you'd have a liberal interpretation of Reconstruction.
Well, obviously, if you put African Americans into the textbooks, you then have to deal with Reconstruction differently than you did before, and that began to change in the 60s. But as I say, there was a sort of tokenism period where, you know, African Americans or Native Americans would be discovered in one period and be totally missing in another, or where, you know, there would be figures who were of not great importance who were suddenly, you know, lifted up to because it's the only ones that the textbooks could find. And now there's been a real sort of a much greater integration, I mean, in both sort of formal and other terms.
Okay. Have the radical scholars of Reconstruction made it into the modern textbooks, the 1990s textbooks?
No.
So we have no Eric Foner interpretations or Staunton Lynn interpretations yet? No?
You never get off to the either end of the spectrum that much.
How about the treatment of Native Americans or as they were once called, Indians in modern textbooks? What term do they use? How is their presence? Are they throughout the whole book now?
It's certainly in the junior high school histories, which are essentially social histories. Mm-hmm. And the one book called The American Nation, which is much used in this state, I understand. And that has Native Americans all the way through it. And I call it the Trail of Tears book because it has four places in which there are full color maps of where the Indians were driven off their lands and back off again. It's interesting because in the case of Native Americans, it's probably the only place where actually somebody does something to somebody else. There is a sexual social conflict involved, and rather refreshing for these textbooks. Also, what they have done, which is, I think, as important as anything else, is that the sort of discovery of Native Americans have meant that the textbooks have had to discover history before the arrival of Europeans, of course, but it also has meant the discovery of Central and Latin America, not to speak of Canada. And all of a sudden, in the 1990s, we turn out to have neighbors, which we never have had before in these texts.
So there's actually a move away from the model you said of the 1890s, that the American history textbook was driven by the idea of a nation state, and this, you know, that was the beginning of the professional textbook.
That's right.
And that was an idea that lasted well to the 1980s, and that's fading now.
Well, I wouldn't say it's fading, but at least there's some recognition that something happened before the nation state and something's happening around it. And perhaps there is more emphasis on social history than there used to be, although in the 30s, that was a big period of social history.
To go back to Native Americans for just a moment, in America Revised, you talked about this one textbook of the 70s, I think, that suddenly, as you say many times, a problem emerges. And they have no idea what the roots are, but they say, it's a problem. And this problem was AIM, the American, the Indian rights movement.
Yeah.
How do they treat AIM now? How do they treat Native American gaming and casinos, if they do at all?
No, I haven't seen that. No, we're just driving them off their land. That's essentially what's happening.
Okay. In other words, they're not as present oriented, as worried about what will happen next week?
Oh, that's quite right. You're quite right, because for a period of time, the fraught part of the books were the last sections. And at this point, they've calmed down a bit. It turns out that not everything is a huge problem waiting to be solved. You know, you sort of trail off. And in fact, one of the interesting things is how quickly the Cold War has disappeared out of the text. Gone. It's like a dream.
So they don't even historicize it. It's just gone.
It's gone. I mean, you go from Lenin to Gorbachev in sort of three pages.
I'm sorry. My jaw is dropping. This explains an awful lot of what about. Okay, then what about the hot part of the Cold War? What about Vietnam?
Vietnam's there. Korean War is, of course, as always, not there. Vietnam War is there.
Yep.
And it's explained not so badly, but they've got their facts wrong still. I can't understand why they can't get it through their head that the Geneva Conference of 1954 did not create two countries. It's always said to be one country, I mean, two countries. And then they say, well, the U.S. Went to help the regime of Ngo Dinh Diem, rather than saying we actually created it, which, you know, happened. So, and then the Diem regime was corrupt. And the Diem regime created the Strategic Hamlet Program. Far from it. This was a, you know, British counterinsurgency expert that did it. So somehow we're at one remove from, you know, the bad stuff out there. And they talk about how difficult it was for the American troops to fight in Vietnam. And sometimes they talk about the damage that the air war caused.
Mm-hmm. Do they talk about environmental damage or of anything of that sort?
I think those are not, that's not the, where they put their environmental stress. It's usually in the United States.
Last question. What's your favorite American history textbook from your first book and from one you've now gone back and revisited?
Well, my favorite's always been David Saville Muzzy, but his textbooks lasted for, I don't know, 50 years, I think. So they changed over time, but there was a real voice there. There was somebody talking to you recognizably, and you, while you might not agree with him, you knew, you know, that he was sort of passionate about various issues. I'm told that there's a wonderful one now, I haven't read it yet, by Joy Hockim, who is has a woman who simply sat down, did the historical research, and wrote this really engaging prose.
They're very, strangely enough, I bought them for my niece. Huh. They're actually a delightful read, and they're also in various, you can break them up and I mean, clearly a publisher was thinking very cleverly. You can break them up and put them in different sections of different courses. They're very social history oriented. They are very, very nicely written too.